BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Welcome back to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time, with old Labour economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Well, many complaints have gone into Avon and Somerset Police about the way 160 riot police over Easter were used to arrest one person suspected of building a petrol bomb. For many, though, going through the police complaints process is not enough, and the police investigating themselves can sometimes seem to be an unsatisfactory way to get justice. So, Lib Dem MP Stephen Williams has come out this week in favour of a new Conservative bill to make squatting a criminal offence. So we talked to one local resident who's injured in the riots, the second of the two riots, who doesn't blame the squatters for the disturbances. Plus, our third extract from Keith Allen's banned film Unlawful Killing about the assassination of Princess Diana, which is being watched everywhere around the world except Britain. Plus, San Francisco's skyscraper architect Richard Gage gave a talk at the Colston Hall on Tuesday evening this week. I spoke to him about the key evidence that proves controlled demolition of the Twin Towers and what this means for America. First, though, to lay out the context of this discussion about the Stokes Croft disturbances, I've tried to get someone from Avon and Somerset Police to come on, but the community relations point of view, to put that point of view. But after initially being promised that possibly yes, and John Stratford a couple of weeks ago was promised that he would come on, we've been since informed by Neve Byrne at Avon and Somerset Police's Corporate Communications Department in Porter's Head that unfortunately this is no longer one of their priorities to speak on this subject. So they've thanked us for the offer, but turned us down. So unfortunately there'll be nobody here putting the police point of view this evening from Porter's Head. So I'm joined in the studio now by Simon Lewis, who's a resident of Montpellier, who was involved in the second of the two disturbances the week Easter weekend. It would have been after Good Friday, just after the Easter weekend. That's on Thursday, the 28th of April. Hi, Simon, and welcome to Drive Time.
Evening, Tony.
Now, can you tell us, first of all, how did you get actually caught up in this? I know you're a resident of Montpellier, you've got a business, you run a building firm. How did you actually manage to get caught up in it? Because for most people, when they see some trouble going on, police running around, they just go in the opposite direction if they want to stay out of trouble.
I don't think it's what residents in my neck of the woods actually do. When there's a bit of trouble outside your front door, you open it and you observe and you make sure that the things settle down. That's how we monitor a lot of things in the neighbourhood. So when I saw a disturbance at the end of my road, it's in my nature to go and investigate and see what the trouble is.
Okay, so roughly what time of the evening was this? And tell us what happened.
I believe I was heading out around about 12:30 and I was heading up Picton Street, the end of my road, and
this is just pretty much parallel with Stokes Croft, isn't it?
It is. I mean, Stokes Croft had been sort of closed off, and what happened previously, I'm not entirely sure. But people had trying to get around Stokes Croft were now filtering back through Montpellier. In fact, you know, Picton Street is a very, very sort of popular route into town; gets a lot of foot traffic. So there was quite a few people starting to gather at the end of Picton Street who were unable to proceed further into town or to get themselves home.
Well, of course, Stokes Croft itself is a major highway, but people by foot and by car. So what was happening to people that actually wanted to go home via Stokes Croft and wanted to use that part of the area? Were the police allowing people to pass?
The police were obstructing, so all the people that were coming down Picton Street were unable to move on. There was a gentleman there who was already very frustrated that he'd already found himself blocked on several occasions, unable to get back to his house on Stokes Croft, and was fairly frustrated with the police. They were obstructing the road, preventing anyone from going further, and before too long they started actually trying to disperse the crowd that was slowly gathering by assaulting people, by pushing people.
But surely this is the normal thing for the police to do. If there's some kind of disturbance going on Stokes Croft itself, then, you know, surely the police officer in charge at the time is going to say, well, look, just can you please, to some of his officers, to go around and make sure we don't get more crowds being drawn into this trouble.
I think having some information would have been useful, because they weren't communicating with us. I struck up a conversation with one of the officers, whose name was James, and tried to find out what was going on and try and relay that back to the crowd that was gathering. I addressed both the police and the crowd on several occasions to try and inform people, and at one point I did actually tell the crowd that they really did have to go in the other direction because things were about to turn nasty.
Okay, so so how did it then proceed for you?
It's a difficult line of events to sort of go over, but basically having spoken with James and tried to negotiate, you know, about not being attacked, and addressing the crowd and dealing with issues there and dispersing some of the issues there, the police then lined up the horses and the dogs, and they'd already sort of shoved us several times and were now sort of coming down much, much harder. I pointed out that we were being lawful and peaceful and that they had no right to do so. They then charged four horses directly at me. Two went down both sides, were pushing the crowd back. I was then assaulted by a police officer or two, hit the ground, and then and the police dog was in my face. And
can we just get this clear? You're in a situation where you are actually trying to get towards Stokes Croft, or and the police are stopping you doing that. You're not actually involved in the disturbances themselves.
Not involved in the disturbances at all.
So
I'm
really
just a resident on my own street saying, why are you assaulting people? Why are you obstructing people? You know, why can these people not make their way home or go on with their business? And you know, more importantly, why are you assaulting us when we're not doing anything unlawful?
Now, the police, if they were here tonight, would be saying to you, why didn't you just go home at that point?
Many of us were trying to go home.
Okay, so you as you were just describing, you actually had a police dog set on you. I mean, what that sounds pretty scary. What was that like?
Well, once I found myself on the floor, and so obviously of no threat to anyone, the first dog was let loose on me. It was on a lead, and I immediately used my right forearm to go into the dog's mouth and push in, which is to sort of gag a dog, and they then sort of lose interest, they can't breathe. So just by pushing in the dog's mouth, I managed to get the dog to release. Meanwhile, a second dog had been put on me, and I received bites around my the top of my right leg, and also my right shoulder blade and armpit. So I then managed to gag the second dog in order to cease the attack. Once that had happened, I was able to get back on my feet. The officers seemed to have no interest in arresting me because I hadn't done anything unlawful. So I then returned back to the middle of the road, where I requested to the police that I would like my glasses back because I couldn't see. And I said, look, before any of you stand on my glasses, can I please have my glasses? And I reminded them that we were all still being peaceful and lawful. That's when they brought the Rottweiler over.
Okay, so had the previous dogs not been? They'd been the normal sort of German Shepherd, Alsatian type dogs.
Yeah, they were sort of fairly small, sort of German Shepherd type dogs. Yeah, bit difficult to recall exactly. But the third dog was a sort of Rottweiler style dog with a docked tail and a very large officer on the end of it.
So if the police were here this evening, I would imagine they would be saying to you, well, actually, what we wanted was to get you away from the you know, push you down Picton Street or away from where the trouble was going on Stokes Croft, to clear that area, to stop, you know, to help stop the rioting and stop other people getting towards it. What would you say to that?
As a resident on my own street, if there's some level of violence going on, then I want to make sure that it ceases, and that whether it's the police or anybody else on my local street that is causing a disturbance, all us residents, you know, as I say, we don't lock our doors, we come out and observe, and you know, I'm completely within my lawful right as a citizen to be stood on my own street. I don't need to be attacked and threatened with violence and brutality in order to just tell me to go in an opposite direction, when naturally, you know, the direction I may need to go in might be the way in which they're obstructing me.
Also, I think there's quite a lot of people we've spoken to about these disturbances. People felt that they actually wanted to be there to witness what was going on.
Of course, our civil liberties were being taken away from us, and many of us in the area are very, very well switched on, to these issues, and we don't want to see our civil liberties being taken away.
And Bristol East MP Kerry McCarthy was down there with another Labour Party member who was a photographer who was actually attacked twice by the police, even though they were just simply there to record events as they were going on. And we had John Peters Coleman on here a couple of weeks ago who was filming and then found himself, as the police had just literally just passed him, he was then, the back of his legs was then attacked with police batons, out of view, of course, of the camera he'd been using. Did you find that... So I think we should really go back to your personal story there, okay, because we left you sort of confronted by a Rottweiler.
Well, my immediate reaction to this Rottweiler being brought over, basically, you know, having already had two dogs set on me, having not committed any crime, I immediately dropped down onto one knee so that I was as small and unthreatening as possible. This also allowed me to make eye contact with the dog as it was brought within striking distance, and I put my left arm in front of my face and pushed down the dog's throat. It's probably a 45-50 kilo Rottweiler, but I'm probably about 80 kilos, so I was able to overpower the dog. And once they've got hold, they're doing their job. They're fairly well-trained animals. It was just holding, of no harm, and I was then able to stand up and addressed the officer that had hold of the dog and reminded him that we were still being peaceful and that we weren't committing any offences. And the officer then started instructing the dog to release. And the dog wasn't releasing, so the officer pulled the dog quite hard, and that's where the dog then tore through my arm. And I had to go to the BRI and under anaesthetic, was straight into surgery to have my arm stitched back on.
So were you actually kept behind in hospital, or did you have when you actually went down to casualty, did you how long did you spend in there?
Well, I was further assaulted at casualty by a police officer. Actually, after the incident, after I'd been bitten, I was then I put my arm in the air to sort of reduce the risk of bleeding, turned around my back to the officer, and was taken by the crowd. Some people tried to take care of me and applied me with gave me something to put on the wound. A police officer then broke lines and took me and the person stood next to me behind the police lines in order to administer some first aid rather rapidly. Luckily, a friend of mine was on the scene who has good experience with these things and was able to redress it properly. The dog handler then came over and suggested that I'd incited violence in his dog. I'm not quite sure, maybe for beating up his other two mates or something. Then I was able to go to the BRI, where in casualty I then was confronted with a plainclothes officer who was very rude to me.
Now, did you approach him, or did you, I mean, I imagine you probably wouldn't if he's plain clothes.
Well, he came into the waiting room where I just received some medication to take the pain away, and he inquired at the desk, came straight over, flashed a card at me, and was very aggressive in the way in which he spoke to me. My friend who was sat with me spoke with him and said, "If you don't mind, I think that's not necessary." Especially in light of the medication that I've just received, and suggest that we maybe ought to have this conversation out of the waiting room, not in the public gaze.
So did you feel that was sort of adding insult to injury, so to speak? Because I'm very surprised that someone who's actually been, if what you're saying is 100% correct, totally abused by the police, simply in your own street, attacked by three dogs, left in a poor medical state, you're having to go to casualty, and then suddenly to have a detective or undercover officer come up and then start abusing you. What exactly was he saying?
I was told that because it was an incident involving a police dog, it was a formality that they had to come and get my details, which is understandable. I'm sure, you know, that's fine. But the way in which you do it is not necessarily by being aggressive and rude. After all, I'm not a criminal. I'm someone that's been bitten by a dog. It was sort of some kind of assumption that I'm some kind of a thug or rioter, and that wasn't the case. I've got plenty of eyewitnesses and video evidence to support the peaceful nature of where we were and what was going on. Likewise with the dog handler that spoke to me shortly after the incident, accusing me of inciting violence. I mean, he was basically beginning to read me my rights. I just informed him that I wasn't coherent enough to understand him.
Do you regret not going back when the police were advancing?
No, I'd do it again.
And what has come out of this? I mean, we've just left you there at casualty, giving your name and address to an undercover officer. Obviously, you're a little bit better now. You're not looking too horrendous. How has this affected your work? Because you run a building firm.
Quite well. I'm unable to lift anything. It's very hard trying to use tools and equipment where you need a lot of strength to hold things steady and safely. I was in physiotherapy again this morning. I'm doing that weekly now. I've got quite a bit of, as well as the actual muscle damage, the part of muscle, I've also got nerve damage, which means that a lot of the muscle isn't responding. So I'm trying to keep myself fit and active and do as much as I can. However, I'm finding it very tiring because only half the muscle's really responding, and it's going to take quite a long time to repair this nerve damage. In the meantime, I'm just trying to keep my firm ticking over and keep my people at work.
So have you managed to do that? Because obviously you can't work yourself.
No, but I'm able to manage the company. I'm just not pulling my weight. So in effect, I'm not actually earning anything, but at least I can keep other people employed.
Now, you're obviously rather irritated with the police about the way they behaved on Thursday, the 28th of April. Have you actually gone down any routes of complaining, making any sort of official complaints? And if so, do you feel that you're getting anywhere?
I must say that I am great friends with all of our local beat officers, all our community support officers, as well as Simon Humphreys. We're all good friends.
Who's Simon Humphreys?
Simon Humphreys is my local beat officer. He's devastated by what's happened. I organise street parties and public events in the area, as well as working closely with the council. I'm the secretary of the park group, and I've been doing stuff with the roads department. So I'm pretty well known with the local police and the local council for the work I do locally. So my relationship with the local police hasn't altered. I'm just offended by the officers that were brought in to behave as thugs, and I find it very disappointing to see.
Where did those officers come from? Do you know?
I don't know where the officers that attacked me came from, but I'm aware that officers were brought in from other districts, from Wales and Somerset and so on, Wiltshire. On the evening that I was attacked, my neighbourhood was full of dozens of police vans, all with people in full riot gear, just sat waiting. And this slowly spread through social networking and invited unsavoury people to visit the area.
But what about your complaints? Have you made any sort of official complaint to the police or claimed any kind of compensation for your injuries?
I now have a solicitor who is dealing with this, and I've done very well to avoid the approach the police would like me to have taken, which can generally lead to a dead end. So I'm having a solicitor deal with these things. A formal complaint has now gone in. It's going to have to be investigated, liable to take 6 to 8 months for an officer to be assigned to investigate what happened. And what we're actually looking at is excessive force is apparently what was used. You know, no warning was given that the dogs were going to be set on me. I wasn't ever given an opportunity to be taken aside by an officer. I mean, they're these great big blokes. I'm only a little lad. You know, they could have simply just said, we're going to arrest you just because we just want you out of the way. But they, you know, they didn't. They were intent on attacking us. My neighbourhood was full of thugs that were enjoying running around with shields and swords, beating people. And now those thugs aren't on the front cover of the Evening Post. There's people described as thugs who apparently stole tobacco from a popular convenience store. Like, I care. What about the thugs that I've got video evidence of? YouTube is full of video evidence of officers assaulting people for no good reason. Those were the thugs that were out on our street.
So what do you think was going on that evening then? Because, I mean, the police would say, of course, that they came down to quell rioting. Apparently people, that particular evening you're talking about, had, for example, got bins, these wheelie bin things, and had put stuff inside them, and those bins were burning. I mean, surely the police have to do something about that.
I saw local residents actually extinguishing these fires, and, you know, someone lighting a piece of cardboard, it's hardly a same level of threat as having three dogs set on you. They didn't come down to resolve the issue. They caused it by being there. They were there for hours and hours beforehand, just waiting. These officers came from a long way away in all these big vans, and everyone in the neighbourhood, every time, you know, you bump into someone in one of the pubs, you go, have you seen the vans? I've just come through here. And, you know, everyone was aware that there was just dozens and dozens of vans. Outside my local pub, there was a van full of 9 officers who'd been cooped up in there all evening. They actually, you know, came in to use the toilet because they were, and we gave them all a cup of tea. And that was just, you know, an hour before they were attacking us.
So what do you want to see happen now?
I'd like to have an inquiry. There is a petition on Bristol City Council's website, e-petition. There's a link to that from a Facebook group. So, inquiry into Stokes Cross disturbances. I would be very grateful if everyone could go and sign that petition, because we need 3,500 ticks on that so that we can try and get the Home Secretary, who is currently ignoring us, to have an investigation into what went wrong.
So have you actually been in touch with the Home Office?
Stephen Williams, my MP, has on behalf of myself and other residents asked the Home Secretary for an inquiry. So far they seem to be ignoring our request, and likewise also John Rogers and Gus Hoyt have been working.
These are two local councillors, and Gus we just had on before the news.
Our Ashley councillors, they've been working hard on my behalf and that of others to ask for an inquiry, because police procedures need to be changed. In London, not very long ago, Ian Tomlinson was assaulted, and he was just trying to make his way home. And these robust tactics that they're using against our own people, this isn't Syria. We're being attacked, we're being oppressed for not doing anything wrong. You know, the presence of those police vehicles on the second Thursday spread and brought troublemakers in. And there was plenty of residents out on the streets that night saying, hey, put that bottle down, I live here. I understand that Chris Chalkley, was from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, was actually invited out to try and help and got assaulted 3 times.
By whom?
By the police. So lots of local residents were out trying to resolve the problems, trying to outnumber the troublemakers. There was very, very few troublemakers there, but there was an awful lot of residents that got caught up in it.
Now, we've just literally heard this week about the proposal from Downing Street to impose on Bristol, which none of the political parties here seem to want, a changeover from having a police authority to having an elected police commissioner. This is supposed to be something which would really help in situations like the Stokes Cross riots. This is the idea is that in very tough neighbourhoods in the United States, elected police commissioners have done good work in calming these kinds of situations. What's your response to that? Do you think that this actually might make a difference in future to have an elected police commissioner rather than the police authority?
I'm a builder. I don't understand how the police work. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, someone's responsible, and I'd like to know who. Currently, either the officers that attacked me, are they to be held responsible for overstepping their protocols, or is it our chief constable that instructed them to be very robust on our neighbourhood because we're not towing the party line, or perhaps the Home Secretary is instructing the chief constable to instruct the local officers. Which one of these three would like to lose their job? Because I've lost mine.
Okay, Martin, could you just answer this question about the police authority? Is this likely, because this has just come in this week, is it likely to make any difference if we have an elected police commissioner to situations like this?
The problem we've got here, the wider picture of what happened in the two nights of disturbances in Stokes Croft, is I think there has been collusion between senior police officers and politicians and probably business interests to create trouble in Stokes Croft in order to discredit protests, in order to get various things through, for example the new Tesco's through that they wanted to get through. Now, I'm not saying this is so, but my copper's instinct at the moment, if I was a copper, is that collusion has taken place. And if we can show that senior police officers like Colin Porter, Avon and Somerset have been colluding to try and create trouble, I would say that's a pretty irresponsible thing to do in inner city Bristol and St Paul's, isn't it, as the economy collapses. I lived in Brixton during both the riots in the 1980s, and frankly the police there behaved just as badly as has been explained to you, and they were racists to boot, and there was a huge price to be paid for that by the community. Eventually the police were reformed, and in fact the local police in Bristol I've always found to be extremely helpful people. But they weren't local police, were they? This is a paramilitary force. It's like bringing the RUC armed with bullets and guns. You know, I mean, apparently Gus was saying to me earlier that he saw somebody, one of the police officers directing traffic, who was actually armed with a pistol. Now, if they want to go down that road, they know they can go down it. But at the other end of that road is Belfast, is Ireland. People in this country who were subjected to that kind of policing tend to react, and then there's consequences. Then they have to start looking under their car every morning before they switch the engine on. They mustn't go the same way to work every day. Is that where we want to go? We've been there. We've done it. We've got the T-shirt. We don't want to go there again.
Okay, now, Simon Lewis, can you just put us in the picture as to how far you've got with your legal complaint? Because you said you're not making an official complaint to the police and asking the police to investigate themselves. So what exactly is it you are doing?
I'm having a solicitor deal with that for me. An official complaint has gone in this week. So yes, an official complaint has been made.
And also, can I ask you? You know, you were talking about the petition. If this sort of thing does happen in Bristol again, is there anything that you think that you can teach our listeners from the experience that you had? I mean, because would you say to them simply stay indoors? Or if you do go out, if you do decide to go out and witness what's going on in your neighbourhood, what advice would you have for people?
A few years back, I remember seeing a television advert for sort of self-policing. It was an incident of, I think it was like a burglar or something. It was like looking at some house, and someone came out of their door, and they were sort of giving them a slow hand clap. And then another member of the public witnessed what was going on and issued another slow hand clap. And if we all observe, we can self-police our own streets. And
it's called Neighbourhood Watch, isn't it?
Well, quite. You know, we've got a very, very good, strong, vibrant community that's very, 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 very positive. And I would recommend that if there's trouble in your street, you should come outside and observe. Because if it comes to the point where you have to stand in front of a tank, then perhaps that's better than us being oppressed and going under house arrest.
Okay, and what about video footage? Because you were saying earlier that someone was actually filming while these dreadful things were happening to you, so I imagine that actually could be quite useful evidence.
There is some wonderful footage that was taken by Vincent from South Bless Community Channel in high definition. In fact, they've got some fantastic shots because of their high definition cameras. So there is some footage of myself on YouTube that was filmed by Vincent addressing the crowd and trying to explain what was going on. To put that short footage into context, I now have all the mobile phone footage from various people that were also at the scene. So it's quite easy to see exactly what was going on. That hasn't been published at the moment, but I think it might be shortly.
You might be using it in court, possibly, as well. Okay, well, Simon Lewis, thanks ever so much for coming and bearing your soul this evening and giving us a bit of wisdom as to how to deal with these kinds of things if this kind of thing should erupt again in the future. Yes, thanks very much for joining us. Now, some music after that. We're going to have Keith Allen and another extract from his band documentary about the death of Princess Diana.
Now the reason we're here as man and woman is to love each other, take care of each other. When love walks in the room, everybody stand up. Oh, it's good, good, good. Like Brigitte Bardot. Now look at the people in the streets, in the bars. We are all of us in the gutter. Some of us are looking at the stars. Look round the room. Life is unkind. We fall, but we keep getting up. Over and over and over. Yeah. Now the reason we're here, every man, every woman, is to help each other, stand by each other. When love walks in the room, everybody stand up.
From 1981, The Pretenders there with their Message of Love, and Chrissie Hynde. Now we have a little extract from the film The Unlawful Killing film by Keith Allen, all about the death of Princess Diana, and also the inquest into her killing, which unfortunately is not able to be watched here in Britain. So here we are, and this week we're having a look at, in fact Keith is having a look at the CCTV evidence, the video evidence which should have shown the crash.
What you are seeing is what the CCTV camera at the entrance to the Armour Tunnel was recording at the time of the crash. Nothing. Because it was switched off, even though it was usually switched on 24 hours a day. Was that just another coincidence? Or something more sinister?
Well, you do ask a good question. You say, how is it that every single traffic camera in that tunnel was switched off for not working?
Even though no cameras recorded the crash, it is beyond doubt that a white Fiat Uno collided with Dodie and Diana's car in the tunnel and contributed to their deaths. The French police tried to deny its existence at first, but too many eyewitnesses saw it, and paintwork from a white Fiat Uno was found on the Mercedes where the two cars had collided. So, who was driving it? Suspicions fell on James Anderson, a photographer with connections to the Secret Services. He had been following Dodie and Diana earlier in the month during their holiday in the Mediterranean, but he was not amongst the paparazzi who were waiting outside the Paris Ritz on the night of the crash.
Anderson was a millionaire paparazzo, a very well-known member of the paparazzi on the continent, made a great deal of money out of Royal Pictures, lived in some style in the French countryside.
He told police that he wasn't in Paris on the night of the crash, but gave two completely different accounts of where he had been. His wife and son also gave him contradictory alibis. Privately, he told friends that he had been there in the tunnel in Paris that night. Crucially, Anderson owned a white Fiat Uno.
It was said of this Fiat Uno that it was up on chocks and didn't work. Well, that appears to be untrue, too. It was driven many hundreds of miles around the French countryside. So the whole question of the Fiat Uno and who was driving it, which is, of course, absolutely crucial, totally crucial to the investigation, has never been resolved, and you have to say, why?
In May 2000, Anderson's body was found in a blazing car in woodland near Montpellier.
In a Ministry of Defence field, shooting range field, in a car which had burned out and locked, but no keys were in the car or in his pocket. And the police claimed he had committed suicide.
They claimed this, even though the fireman who found him says he saw two bullet holes in Anderson's skull. You don't have to be a conspiracy theorist to point out that it's difficult for a man to shoot himself twice in the head and then set fire to his own car before dying.
And we'll have the final extract from Unlawful Killing by Keith Allen on the programme next week. Now, San Francisco skyscraper architect Richard Gage gave a talk at the Colston Hall on Tuesday evening this week. Martin Summers was actually introducing Richard, as I understand it. Martin, how did it go?
It was Hall 2 in the Colston Hall, which holds 230 to 240 people. It was full. We turned away 20 or 30 people on the night. But unfortunately, the Evening Post had advertised, they did a very good coverage of it earlier in the week, that advertised the meetings on Thursday. So a lot of people turned up last night, and we had to go down there and talk to those people. And there was another 30 or 40 there. So it was very successful in terms of numbers of attendees, and also in terms of media coverage in the city.
So what was the key reason for his talk? What was it actually entitled or whatever?
I can't remember the exact title. It was 9/11 Blueprint for Truth. Basically, he's a guy who builds these kind of buildings for a living, and most people who listen to this programme will be aware that three skyscrapers, not two skyscrapers, collapsed into their own footprints on September 11th, 2001. And being as he's one of those chaps that builds these buildings, he immediately smelled a rat and started to investigate it, because buildings don't just collapse into their own footprints without being blown up, basically.
Thanks, Martin. Well, I spoke to Richard Gage just before he gave his talk on Tuesday evening down at the Colston Hall about the key evidence that proves controlled demolition and what this means for America.
I'm Richard Gage. I'm an architect of 23 years. I'm a member of the American Institute of Architects. I'm from the San Francisco Bay Area. And I founded the Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth in March of 2006. We now have 1,500 architects and engineers calling for a new investigation of the destruction of all three World Trade Center skyscrapers on 9/11 as a result of the evidence that is overwhelming and indisputable as to their explosive destruction.
Now, you say explosive destruction, and you talk about evidence, and you also talk about three different buildings. First of all, what evidence have you got that the Twin Towers, never mind this other building, were brought down by a controlled demolition then?
The Twin Towers, we're told, came down as a result of column failure in the perimeter columns, and that the upper 12-story section drove the rest of the building down to the ground in this massive structural failure as a result of office fires and jet plane impacts. Problem is, the videos and photos betray that illusion. What we really see is in the North Tower, the 12-story section above the point of jet plane impacts begins a precipitous destruction of itself, as such that in the first 4 seconds, that section has been completely destroyed, and with bands of explosions, the way the first responders described it. And then after that, we see the building tearing itself apart, hurling 4-ton perimeter wall units at 70 miles an hour, landing up to 600 feet away, and trailing streamers of outward arching, expanding plumes of very hot gases in a complete equal distribution of debris about 1,400 feet in all directions outside the perimeter of each of these towers.
But isn't that what you'd expect? If the top of the building started to collapse, surely it would force the bottom part of the building outwards.
No. What we would expect is that gravity would work its way down, not upward and outward. We're missing, for instance, about 110 floors in each of these buildings at the bottom of the pile. We don't have a series of pancakes. We'd expect to find 10 or 15 or 50 of them. We don't find one down there. What we see in the photos and videos is a two-story pile of core columns, perimeter columns. We're missing not only 90,000 tons of concrete at the base of these buildings, which we see, by the way, being pulverized in midair up above to a fine powder, which is distributed throughout lower Manhattan in this 3-square-mile area of a blanket 4 inches thick. And in that blanket of concrete powder, officials, U.S. Geological Survey, find what amounts to billions of tiny iron-rich microspheres, previously molten iron microspheres. They have no explanation as to how they came from, where they came from, but they're obviously molten iron, which means there are temperatures far exceeding what jet fuel and office fires can produce, which in turn are obviously accountable for this incredible hot expansion of gases we see trailing these freely flying heavy structural sections away from the perimeter of the buildings. So we have in all of this dust as well the evidence of this molten iron, which has the chemical evidence in it of thermite. Now, thermite is an incendiary used by the military to cut through steel like a hot knife through butter. So why do we have all of the evidence of thermite in the World Trade Center dust, ignited thermite, as well as pools of molten iron, which have in it the evidence of, in addition to molten iron, manganese, aluminum, and other elements that are associated with the aftermath of thermite. Not only that, though, this small team of scientists from around the world, led by Niels Harrit from Copenhagen, they find small red-gray chips. The red side is composed of extremely small particles of iron oxide and aluminum powder, which are intimately combined and intermixed in the perfect percentage to become thermite. The problem with this stuff, even worse than that, is that they're so small, they're at the nanoscale. These are perfectly uniform particles of nanothermite, aluminum powder, iron oxide, that are made only in the most sophisticated defense contracting laboratories. This should not be found in all the World Trade Center dust samples, and the four samples they have were collected from some of them 10 minutes after the collapse, some of them on top of a high rise. So these are not contaminated by cleanup operations, for instance. We have a 25-page peer-reviewed paper that these materials and the testing of them done by this team of scientists are done in. And this paper stands uncontested in the last year and a half. The way to challenge somebody's conspiracy theory is to put forth your own peer-reviewed paper challenging their work, and this has not been done. They just simply call us conspiracy theorists and call this paint chips, but obviously they're not paint chips. Paint chips, for instance, don't ignite at 420 degrees centigrade in a heater, producing molten iron microspheres that match the same chemical makeup as those that the USGS found in all the World Trade Center dust. So we have some serious problems with the official story. It's proved not only in the behavior of these three buildings, but in the aftermath, the extreme hot temperatures and chemical signatures involved.
Okay, tell us about this third building then. It's called World Trade Center Building 7. Most people have never heard of this building. And can you tell us why you think that the collapse of that building is also significant?
Yes, this is a 47-story skyscraper associated with the World Trade Center, a football field a length away from the North Tower. And at 5:20 in the afternoon, this building collapses in just 6.5 seconds. This is rather extraordinary because it wasn't hit by an airplane. It had only a few small fires in it from the debris, presumably from the North Tower. And yet they blame it on normal office fires, with a new phenomena called thermal expansion. Well, never before have office fires brought down a skyscraper, ever. And we have this skyscraper that looks exactly like a controlled demolition. I mean, it falls uniformly, suddenly, symmetrically, straight down into its own footprint almost, at free fall acceleration. This building could not have done that due to office fires. I mean, the office fires would have to have taken out all 80 columns on at least 8 floors, synchronistically timed, floor by floor, and within a tenth of a second of each other on each floor. This is the only way you can bring a high-rise building straight down into its own footprint. You know, any damage from fire in a building would have caused it to fall over if it was going to collapse at all. But never in the history of up to 100 fires in office and skyscrapers have we had one collapse. We want a new investigation of World Trade Center 7 as well. I mean, NIST tells us this elaborate theory of how fire brought this building down. And we see in their computer model, their attempt to prove how this building came down by fire, it's so ludicrous because you see the massive failure rate of these beams and columns throughout the inside of this building. 400 structural steel connections are failing every second in order to bring this building down like a house of cards.
So you mentioned they then. Who is it that's done this particular analysis, which certainly sounds a little bit suspect?
Yeah, this is NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, who was tasked with explaining these collapses of all three skyscrapers to us, the American people. And they will not release the computer input data for any of these buildings. They cite that it would jeopardize public safety were they to release this information. Of course, the reverse is true. It jeopardizes public safety by withholding this information from the architects and engineers who are responsible for designing safe skyscrapers.
So what does this mean for America, for Americans, and for the Western world? Because it sounds, from what you're saying, as if there's an absolutely colossal cover-up here, and possibly a criminal conspiracy too at the highest levels with September the 11th attacks, and that basically the public and the politicians around the Western world have been sold a pup.
Well, yes, 9/11 was used as a pretext to invade two countries in which already over a million people have perished. We've lost thousands of soldiers in the U.S. and in the U.K. If 9/11 is in question, then the entire war and terror and everything that's ensued from it, the loss of civil liberties, etc., is in question. This is a huge issue. I mean, this is the story of the century. The people all across the world deserve to know the truth, and it will shake the foundations of power, is my guess. That being said, it's been very difficult for us to break through into mainstream media, and we have a few reasons that might be true. I mean, we know in the U.S., for instance, that 90% of the American mainstream media is owned by just 6 corporations. This is extraordinary in and of itself. But when you look and see who sits on the boards of directors of those corporations, you find that it's the same people that sit on the boards of directors in the arms industry, the banking industry, the oil industry, the insurance industry. This is extraordinary, and they all profited enormously from 9/11. There's some real reckoning here by the media, certainly, and the American people, who should be taking their media back, finding out how we were manipulated to not even know the truth about the explosions, the molten metal, the explosive nature of these buildings.
Yeah, because it's 10 years, slowly the truth is filtering out in one way or another 10 years after the event. But this is immensely dispiriting for people who think that they live in a democratic part of the world.
Yeah, it is. And for that reason, and who knows, a whole bunch of other reasons, people don't want to look at this issue. It's very difficult to get people into this hall tonight here in Bristol and be willing to face the possibility that this could be some sort of an inside job, which is the obvious implication of the information we're bringing to bear here tonight. Most people would rather just continue with their worldview that is safe and controlled and has a packaged presentation of the world that where it's tidy and everything's in its place. Unfortunately, upon hearing this information, it makes us feel unsafe. It caused me to go through a certain amount of shock in the weeks following my awareness through the radio of an interview that David Ray Griffin gave in March of 2006, where I had to, you know, for the last 4 years prior to that, I believed the official story. I'm an architect. I saw those buildings come down. I had an uneasy feeling when they were coming down, but I didn't have any support for those feelings. I just believed the official story. I supported going to war in Iraq and Afghanistan and believed we had to end the problem of being attacked. Didn't have a clue, not even a remote possibility, that it might have been some group of people on the inside manipulating these events to draw America and others into these wars. It's a rude awakening for a Reagan Republican to begin to realize that the world is not as I thought it was. The people who run things do not have our best interests in mind, apparently.
So do you think that there's any light at the end of the tunnel with all this? I mean, there's obviously raising awareness about the 9/11, but it's quite worrying if we think that the people who were in power then, to a large extent, certainly the military, the civil service, people like Robert Gates, the US Defense Secretary, well, they're all still in power.
Yeah. By outward appearances, it would seem that we have an awful long way to go to raising awareness. We have had some media breakthroughs, for instance, on Geraldo at Large, Fox News, one of our, for 10 minutes anyway, we had one of our petition signers and a family member calling for an investigation, showing Building 7 coming down to the American people. That was extraordinary. But nothing happened as a result, and that was last November, 6 months ago. So, watching the progress of 9/11 Truth after 5 years, it's like watching a swimming pool fill up. You don't see much progress, but if you take the temperature of people on the street when you're handing out literature out there, there is more receptivity now, 5 years later, than when we started. So it's as if the unconscious of the American people are being filled up with awareness at the unconscious level, and then I think at some point, you know, something's going to happen where it will break through and snap across the spectrum of people on the left and the right who will be calling for a new investigation of not only these buildings but their elected representatives and the media who've been hiding this information.
And can you see a restoration of democracy and that kind of thing in the future? Because the challenge of your interpretation of the 9/11 events is really a challenge of democracy and about whether the people are informed and able to choose those who represent them as their good and honest leaders.
Yeah, I can see the obvious problems. If we don't have the information, the truth about events in our world from our media, which we depend on for that, then we are being manipulated and our democracy is at stake and has been at stake and is in terrible shape. So what have our elected representatives been doing who gave us their faith in the 9/11 Commission report, you know, as well as the 9/11 Commission itself, which was supposed to have been a bipartisan commission. All those people had tremendous conflicts of interest, and the ones who didn't quit. And so Max Cleland, for instance, citing that it was a national scandal, the investigation was compromised. Well, it's not just the investigation, the 9/11 Commission, but apparently all of most of our elected representatives, because we've given them all this information at this point. The 9/11 Blueprint for Truth, our DVD, has been given to every member of Congress. We've spoken to personally with the staff of a couple, three dozen of them now. So we're, with very few exceptions, we've made almost no headway there. They have an accounting, a reckoning to do. We do need to take back our democracy. Probably most Democratic and Republican representatives need to be replaced.
That was Richard Gage there, San Francisco skyscraper architect, and I spoke to him earlier this week at the Colston Hall just before he gave his talk there. His website, if you're on the internet, is www.ae911truth.org. That's AE, that stands for the Architects and Engineers, AE911truth.org. And his film, he was talking about there, the DVD. If you don't want a DVD, you don't have a DVD player, find someone, and even if you don't have the internet, find someone who does, and you can watch his two-hour presentation, pretty much similar to what he gave at the Colston Hall. It's called 9/11 Blueprint for Truth, and you can watch that on good old YouTube. So that's all for this week. Coming up next, Sky News at 7. Thanks for our guests in the first hour, Green Councillor for Ashley and St Paul's, Gus Hoyt. Next week, an explosive topic as we ask former soldiers what they make of cuts to the armed services and the strategy and tactics of present-day foreign policy. Thisweek.org.uk is our website. See you next week.
CFM is the community radio station for Bristol. And